saw the trees.
There were people in there that was.
This is voluntary.
Pork cake, all those present. All others are excused. Hearing on 2600 engrossed. Is there anybody wishing to testify this morning on any particular issue? We don't have a Dick. Three strikes and you're out, Dick.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dick Goss. Last Friday, the issue of group self-insurance came up, and I have a prepared presentation. There was some question about just what reciprocal insurers were. The insurance code provides for three different kinds of insuring entities. One is a stock carrier, another is a mutual insurance company, and the third is reciprocal insurance company. As I say in my testimony, group self-insurance is nothing more than reciprocal insurance, and it's defined in the insurance code, and I've set out the definition there. Essentially, it's the last three lines. Inter-exchanging among themselves reciprocal agreements of indemnity. This is exactly what group self-insurance does. In fact, self-insurance is a misnomer because the employer is not insuring himself. The group is insuring each other. These are groups of employers banding together to set up their own insurance company. There's no compelling reason why they should not have the same safeguards as required of other reciprocal insurers under the insurance code. These safeguards are all the more necessary for workers' compensation, where liabilities may stretch for 20 to 40 years in the future. ORS 731.5661 requires reciprocal insurers writing workers' compensation to maintain a surplus of $1.5 million. 731.628 requires insurers writing workers' compensation to deposit a minimum of $100,000 with the state treasurer, and reciprocals must deposit an additional $50,000. Self-insurers in this state have overall done a very good job in workers' compensation, but that experience is not transferable to groups because this is not self-insurance. This is true insurance, spreading the risks over all the members. Self-insurance has worked so well because there is one employer who has total control over the operation. He can make safety, return to work, and other industrial relations activities part and parcel of his production goals. Also with the group, there is not the financial stability and security of one large employer such as Georgia Pacific or FMC. Small businesses have a high mortality rate and are more subject to the fluctuations of the economy. There are many industries in this state particularly comprised of small businesses that open and close dependent upon the interest rate and the housing market. Since this bill requires members to be in the same industry, there could be groups that have most of its members failing. This is all the more reason why groups should be required to have at least the same safeguards of reciprocal insurers as provided in the insurance code. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm sure see what he's saying.
I do too.
You make a good point with that, I must say.
Yeah, I in trying to think of some of the groups that might come in as a request, group self-insurance, one that I know that is very interested in is the Fred Van Ettis group. And I'm not sure what size employers are included in his organization or that organization. If they're very small or very large.
Most of them are smaller.
Those are the types of
high risk ones,
businesses that come in and out. Carpenters who go into the framing business and stay in it for a year and then fail and go back to work for somebody else. Those are precisely the ones that don't stay in business very long.
Fred isn't here, is he?
Well, I'd have a real problem supporting any plan that gave them a group like that to the option to, if you wish, self-insure as a group.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
Dick, in your opinion, if you're in this group where you've had self-insurance and say there were some bad experiences, what would prevent individual employers from all of a sudden selling or getting out or liquidating or something just to get out from under it? And pretty soon the burden would be on just a few. Did that happen?
Yes, I see that happening, because all you have to do is go into bankruptcy, and there goes all the liabilities that you had, and all the other employers would have to pick that up. All the other employers in the group would pick it up. If the group failed, then all the other group self-insurers under this statute would then have to pick it up. There is a guarantee fund, if you will, provided in the statute. So if the group as an entire entity failed, then the rest of, I think all the self-insurers would have to pick it up. I think that's how the statute, this bill reads.
What currently happens now with the self-insured there?
Self-insurers, there is a guarantee fund. If a self-insurer should fail, all the other self-insurers have to pick up those liabilities.
And they would be, these groups would fold into that same framework, is what you're
yes.
saying?
Yes. I believe it's one common fund for all self-insurers, groups and individuals.
Is there any merit at all in putting in a number of a minimum number of employees or a minimum amount of, I don't know, worth before they could self-insure, group self-insure?
Well, the provision in 104 has a minimum net worth for the group of $1 million. However, when you think about it, if there's only 10, the minimum number is in the group is 10. 10 divided into a million is only $100,000. So you have 10 employers only worth $100,000 apiece. That isn't very substantial when you consider reciprocals have to actually set aside in surplus $1.5 million.
Mr. Chairman,
Parkinson.
We certainly need testimony from the other side, if there is another side.
Yeah, it's
Mr. Chair, I recall Friday hearing, and there was some indication that one of the groups interested in this concept were some of the political subdivisions. Have they indicated any further interest in the group self-insurance? Or
Kirk?
Yeah, I'd like to speak on Wednesday regarding we're looking at some things as a variety of protections. I think the issue presented here is, I don't know if any local governments are not out of business. There's some that are pretty
close to it, huh?
Mr. Could Kirk address the issue on Wednesday of one political subdivision insuring another political subdivision?
What
are you alluding to?
One political subdivision insuring another?
Yes, if
that's what this would do.
Risk, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right. Mr. Chair?
It's the importance of insuring Beaverton.
Mm-hmm. Wait, Beaverton bails out Portland all the time. I was curious about having someone come that had proposed this idea, the kind of safeguards they'd set up. I'm sure the criticism that you're bringing up is one that has to be dealt with. How would one carry that? How would you share the burden in case of bankruptcy and drawing out with a claim charged against that? You know, what are the various mechanisms set up to deal with the problems you've articulated here from the people that are advocating this position?
I don't know how much light I'll be able to shed.
John McCulley, Small Business Advocates. A lot of the people in the small business community are supporting the concept of group self-insurance. And a couple months ago, Legislative Research compiled a study of all of the states that have enacted group self-insurance, and there are 7 nationwide as of January 1st, 1980. I'm putting together a chart. I don't have it finished yet on the requirements of each of those states, but just basically, the 7 states vary in requirements from 2 to 5 employers participating in the group, and then most of them leave it up to the insurance commissioner or workers' compensation department to set up the financial parameters that those group self-insurers have to meet. All of them, most of them require some type of surety bond or securities deposited, held by someone, ranging from $100,000 to $250,000. That would provide that extra measure of security. Most of the states require that they all be in the same industry, those people who want to group self-insure. And then there are some that do set in statute minimum net worth requirements. That's basically what the other states have done. Now, I don't know how successful those programs have been or if there have been any problems, but there are the 7 states that may have some experience by now, since most of them have been in it for at least a year.
Can you say, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Can you say the Legislative Council had done some...
Legislative Research did, right, for Representative Riebel. And I just have one copy of their page report, and then I'm putting together a little description of what every state requires. And one state does, Kentucky, does allow group self-insurance for municipalities or local governments.
Maybe we should ask them to find out some more about how that did work. How it does work.
Where were the states? Do you have the list?
Yeah, most of them are in the South. Arkansas, Florida, Kentucky, Louisiana, New York, North Carolina, and Virginia.
Florida.
The only other comment that we would offer concerning this, if some type of group self-insurance is going to be amended into 2600, we do think that the net worth requirement is very important. That $1 million that's mentioned in Senate Bill 104, I think, is a very realistic figure. The other part of Senate Bill 104 that talks about minimum premium of $1 million, we would prefer to see about $500,000 rather than $1 million, mainly because we feel that the strength, the financial security of the business in paying whatever claims may be filed would come out of the net worth, and the premium really has more to do with the risk between the groups rather than their ability to pay on a claim.
Go ahead. It just seems that, you know, this group self-insure thing, you look at, say, the construction industry and try to establish a program, unless there is really a solid financial guarantee, I can't think of a riskier business to be self-insuring. And I guess there are others out there with the same sets of problems. guess my first reaction is I'm not very enthused with the idea of letting groups self-insure.
Let me maybe kind of set a direction. It would not be my intent to amend group self-insurance into House Bill 2600. I think that's an issue that we need to look at separately. And I'd like to deal with it as a separate issue. There are so many questions about it anyway. It may be that we'll find that there's some way to make it workable, but as I said before, we keep chasing this animal through the brush and picking up these burrs. That's not to say that group self-insurance is burr, but we'll get into it quite a bit further. We'll hear from the locals, and I think Fred Bennett, I know, wants to say something on it too. So we'll get back to this. Is anybody else at this point talk about group self-insurance? Scotty, you had an amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Evelyn Pierce for the Oregon Workers' Compensation Federation. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you'll remember that when we were going through Section 3 of the bill, which had to do with notice after the employer received notice of the injury, then contact by the insurer or self-insured employers with the worker. And at the time, we said that that would need some amendment because of the fact where it says on Section 3, subparagraph 1, that the insurer, self-insured employer of an injured worker shall be responsible for contacting the worker within 5 days after the insurer, self-insured employer had knowledge of the injury and so forth, that this was all-inclusive of all injured workers, and probably 80% of the injured workers would be back to work within 21 days, so that it was kind of a needless expense for the insurer, self-insured employer, to contact the worker. In other words, if they've gone home with a sprained muscle or something like that, that the doctor says stay off work for a couple weeks and be back, there really isn't much need for contact. However, we recognize that the committee's intent is certainly on those persons who are injured, and we're not talking about the person who's hospitalized, but the person who is injured. It was the committee's intent to contact them so that they knew what was waiting for them, etc. So with that in mind, the chairman asked both SAFE and us to get together with some amendments, and we did. We used the Section 3 that you had and simply said on Section 3, Paragraph 1, oh, here, I've got, I'm hoping I've caught this up, sort of warm enough. The effect of the amendments would be to say that the insurers or self-insured employer of workers who incur compensable injury shall contact the worker within 5 days after a receipt of a medical report which indicates the worker may be unable to return to work for a period of 21 days or longer, or B, when the worker has been off work for more than 21 days since the date of the injury, and shall assist such workers to return to the workforce as soon as possible. So it would say that within 5 days after the insurer had noticed that there was a possibility that they would be off work more than 21 days, they should immediately contact the worker, or if the worker had been off work 21 days. We thought this accomplished what the committee wanted to do without the really needless expense of contacting everybody who was off work.
How many people are affected if we let, or how many people would the insurers have to contact, do you think,
if we left the bill like it is?
We'd have to contact everybody.
Okay, but roughly how many in a year would that be in thousands? Do you have any idea?
45,000.
45,000.
Am I right, Virginia, that about 80% of them are back to work within the 20? Yeah.
80% of those 45,000 are back?
Within 21 days.
Within 21 days.
Mm-hmm. It's usually like could be a pulled tendon, something that they need a little healing period, but they know it's not going to be of any prolonged period.
Mr. Chair. Steve, okay, Carl, have you seen this?
Are these the ones you showed us about 2 or 3 weeks ago?
Yeah.
2 or 3 weeks.
Okay, receipt within 5 days after insurance. So the employer must notify the carrier in the case of insured,
mm-hmm.
All right?
Mm-hmm. And then within 5 days after that, notice why they would contact him.
Okay, now let's go back.
Which is considerably shorter, I might add, Mr. Chairman, than the present law.
Yeah.
How would the medical report get issued?
Yeah.
What's the mechanics of that? Okay.
That's what I'm trying to.
I'm trying to find out the system.
From day one. We got a blackboard over there that. Do we need that anymore?
Thanks, Mike.
We still need that.
Not need the other
side. Is there the other sign?
Is there two sides to that, or is it? How would you say it would work from the mechanics of it? How would that medical report get to the...
It goes directly to the insurer or the self-insured employer.
Okay. And is that part of the current process, is what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so the... But how... There's no assurance it's going to happen, as I recall, within a reasonable time.
Well, within 5 days under this amendment.
A receipt of it, but it seems to me that we found that those medical reports don't get filed very promptly sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's a, that there's the potential for weeks to go by before those filings occur.
Yeah, I think I don't have a copy of the report our group did, but I think they found that there was an average of 13 days before, after the injury, before the medical report was received.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I think, Scotty, I recall as well, there was a problem noted in your study that a lot of the times, the first medical report, the doctor's unable to make that kind of determination. And in fact, if the doctor does try to determine the length of the disability, more likely than not, that estimate's wrong, and that they're too conservative, or they're really not in a position to estimate.
Well, I, because I can't speak for the medical profession, but it seems to me that a doctor on examining a injured worker would have a pretty good idea as to whether this was a temporary thing, or if it wasn't. That's why, incidentally, Representative Springer, that's why we put in the B in there, where the worker has been off work for more than 21 days, consecutive days since the date of injury, so that if there was a case where the doctor didn't anticipate it would be longer than 21 days, but it actually turned out to be longer than 21 days, that then the obligation also would be to contact him within 5 days.
Let's see if we can come up with mechanically on trying to get to date of injury. That's day one. Okay, date of injury. And the say in the case of the worker who ends up in the hospital, serious injury. The employer, of course, knows right away, I would think. Who do they notify first?
Oh, the employer is supposed to notify the insurer right away. I think Virginia can probably go this.
The law says immediately, but not later than 5 days, they shall notify the insurer.
So the insurance company.
We got 5 days then, right there. Date of injury, of course, the employer knows, right? Sure, it's 5 days.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's not necessarily true on the date of injury. Mm-hmm. It's the date of receiving medical attention.
Well, we're talking about a severe case where the date of injury ends the work ends at the hospital first.
Oh, all right.
All right. The other time. Okay, so that's 5 days. No. So the next contact, or the next step, would be the contact with the injured worker by the carrier, right?
And also field service.
So, so let's say this is the employer, insured, 5 days,
mm-hmm.
and then it would be insure. Now let's call it an injured worker.
Yeah, let's correct that. Statute 265 is immediately, but not later than 30 days.
All right, that's
so it's not up to 30.
30, right here, right? Okay, now.
No, that can't be right.
That's still five. Yeah, the worker has up to 30 days. Okay,
yeah.
But we're talking about the injured worker has 30 days.
Yeah.
But we're talking about...
He has to notify within five, because that's where we got into the fact that you were actually not receiving them until 13 days.
Okay, now the insurer contacts the injured worker, and what we're saying right now is 5 days.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that could be 10 days. No, what we're seeing now is within 5 days after receiving the medical report.
Okay, that's what I want to get now. Okay, so now it's not that, but it's the medical report to the insurer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's the requirement there?
72 hours.
That's not a serious disabling injury.
That's what we're talking about, serious. We're talking about a serious. This is a...
This is hospitalization.
Okay, so then it's 3 days. Okay. Now we've got the insurer notifying the injured worker. We're saying 5 days.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. What is the insurer notifying the injured worker here?
That's contact.
This proposal.
Right.
Under 2600.
So it's 13 days before there would be the day of injury, possibly. 13 uh-huh. days, according to the law, if this were passed.
Uh-huh.
From the date of injury until the insurer or self-insured. Would have to notify or have to contact the injured worker.
Actually, number two and three are in the alternative, because the employer is supposed to notify the insurer within 5 days, but in addition, the doctor is supposed to notify the insurer within 3 days, so there's two different routes.
So that's one either or then.
And this is basically what we're talking about in reality for the most part. All there are others there.
You might want to put after this. They
why not
what actually have
somebody else
what?
Get up there and draw some numbers.
I think what happened in the past, Mr. Chairman, which there was a committee which this would attempt to correct, whether or not, aside from the amendment, is that that before you waited many times until it was determined whether the injury was compensable before there was any contact. And as you know, that can be a long time sometimes.
Right.
And this we have tried to avoid by simply saying that there should be contact. Now, recognizing the fact that it may turn out not to be compensable, and in those cases, when we've discussed it between us, in those cases where that did turn out to be the fact, we would simply say to those, and we expected that maybe that might be the outcome, we would simply, under, you know, the law as it is in 2600, we would simply say to that worker, we don't know yet whether your injury is going to be determined to be compensable because we aren't sure whether it's work-related or what, but nonetheless, this is the sequence that would follow if it is determined to be compensable. And I think that would accomplish a lot of what the committee is trying to do, is that early contact. All we're trying to do with this amendment is to avoid contacting everybody, those 80% that are just off for a few days and are going to be right back, because that just adds cost to the system that doesn't seem to be of any benefit.
Okay.